Enron was truly a trial of the century. It had everything: massive egos, bigger-than-life lawyers, and a massive fraud. On this special series from the Compliance Podcast Network, Tom Fox is joined by Lauren Steffi, who was a business journalist while it was all happening. Tune in for his reflections and new insights on the first trial of the century for the 21st century.
This is Tom Fox. I hope you'll join me for my special five-part podcast series on the Enron trial, together with Lauren Steffi, the former business columnist for the Houston Chronicle during the Enron trial. We take a look at all phases of the trial. In episode two, we look at the trial as it begins. How long did the trial go? What did the prosecutors have to prove? And how did they go about proving a complex accounting fraud scandal? What was the doofus defense? And how did Jeff Skilling and Ken Lay try to use this? What were the lawyers like in the case, as we had some high star power lawyers? And Skilling's legal team even salting the Houston Chronicle blogs to try to get the case moved on a change of venue. All this and more on episode two of the Enron trial.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox back with Lauren Steffi for our five-part series on the Enron trial. Lauren, welcome back.
Thanks.
Lauren, this episode is entitled The Trial Begins. And I can't think of a civil trial in the city of Houston or the county of Harris that was as anticipated as this trial. So could you tell us a little bit about the atmosphere? And you've sat through multiple trials. What was it like really that first day or in the buzz around the courthouse?
You know, this was actually a criminal trial, but it was the biggest, it was the trial of the century. I think Jeff Skilling's lawyer, Daniel Petrocelli, actually referred to it that way in his opening arguments. You know, this is the Enron trial. It's the trial of the century. Even though the century was only a few years old, it really had that feel that this was like a monumental legal undertaking. And it wasn't just because Enron had been such a big, prominent company, certainly in Houston, had very much been a part of the community, had employed, you know, tens of thousands of people. But it was also this sense that you just didn't see large companies like this completely implode. You didn't see prosecutions of executives. And part of the reason you didn't see that is these are very, very hard cases to prove, right? These kinds of white-collar criminal cases against executives, especially in a situation like Enron. I mean, it was what the prosecution was trying to prove was that the top executives of the company had conspired to defraud shareholders and employees, right? But they couldn't really make the argument that they did it for personal gain, because Skilling left the company in June, 5 months before everything began to fall apart. But he kept most of his stock. There were no obvious signs that he had personally profited from what happened at Enron. And so it was very hard to prove greed. It was much more hubris. They wanted this company to be something bigger and better than it was. And that desire for success, for personal achievement, for recognition, whatever, was really the driving factor. So it was a very, very difficult case to prove going into it. And there were many, many moments over the 5 months that the trial lasted that we sort of wondered, like, are they making their case? Because it was really hard to tell.
In addition to this being a fraud case, it was even more eccentric because it was accounting fraud. And I would say you're a storyteller at heart in the various forms you've written over the years. And a prosecutor has to tell a story. How did they tell a story about the nitty-gritty of accounting fraud tied into hubris in a way that resonated with the jury?
They tried not to go into a lot of accounting detail. There was one day, I remember, when we got into, you know, some of the really down in the weeds, and Skilling was in his element. I mean, it was like he was conducting an investor seminar or something, and he was on the stand. But what they really tried to show was that the company knew it was misrepresenting its finances and its business to the public. And so, for example, they had the vice president of investor relations talking about how Skilling would rewrite the earnings statements the night before they were released, right? Enron always beat Wall Street estimates by one penny every quarter. It was consistent. And the reason that happened was because Skilling would look at the estimates and he would take the earnings release and he would change the number. He would add a penny to what the estimates were, and that would be the earnings per share. And then they would reverse engineer the financial statement every quarter. And that was, to me, very telling. I mean, this guy who was the vice president of IR, it's like he knew this was happening and he went along with it. This is not your typical sort of hardened criminal or swindler or something like that. This is somebody who was doing what his boss told him to do. He knew it wasn't right, but he had a good thing going. Enron was a great company to work for. It was exciting. It was dynamic. People wanted to work there. They thought they were doing all these innovative things. Nobody wanted to lose their position in the company. They didn't want to lose their jobs. And they wound up getting caught up in this. Nancy Rappaport was actually with U of H Law School still at the time. And she was the one that made the point that if you're familiar with the Milgram experiment, which is a thing that was done in the 50s to try to understand how so many people in Germany went along with the Nazis, right? And it was like, you know, these were not necessarily people that believed in what the Nazis were doing, but they didn't stand up to them. The Milgram experiment is basically you have a guy in a lab coat that's telling someone to essentially torture somebody in another room. And because you have an authority figure telling you that, you're inclined to do it. It's sort of human nature. And I think that really applied in many ways to Enron. People thought they were doing what the guys at the top of the company wanted them to do. And so really the prosecutors tried to focus on that aspect, that this was a question of people being manipulated almost on an emotional level, and that the executives knew what they were saying was not true, and they were basically getting everybody to go along with it. And it was this just sort of massive lie that they were telling Wall Street.
You told us a little bit about the prosecution. What are your thoughts about the defense?
The defense had a really tough time. You know, again, having covered business for many, many years, you see this a lot. CEOs are used to being in charge. They're used to being the boss. And when they hire lawyers, they're used to the lawyers doing what they're told to do. If you're a corporate executive, you hire a corporate lawyer, you tell them, go out and, you know, do this deal or make this work or fix this problem. Well, when you're on trial in a criminal case, it's a very, very different thing. You know, there was one point where Ken Lay was on the stand and he openly questioned his attorney, Mike Ramsey. He actually said, you know, Ramsey asked him a question, and rather than answer it, Lay said, "Where are you going with this, Mr. Ramsey?" We did a regular roundup, a weekly blog on the trial, and a couple of the defense attorneys that we had that were providing perspective said, this is the turning point in the case. I mean, that was just so devastating that, you know, you just showed the jury that you don't trust your own lawyer. And so I think the defense had a really, really tough time. I guess I'll also mention that they used some unusual tactics. We found out that Skilling's legal team was actually posting anonymous comments on our blogs at the Chronicle and had been doing it for months leading up to the trial. Anytime we wrote about things, of course, I was writing an opinion column, so some of my stuff was a little more pointed. And they were really, you know, pretty actively salting comments in the blog. I had not encountered that before. That was an interesting legal tactic.
So you almost became a part of the story as well.
Well, you know, it's interesting because they made a motion to move the trial because of pretrial publicity, and they used screenshots of my blog. And one of the screenshots actually had a comment from their person that they had been posting, you know, under false pretenses or whatever, anonymously. It was actually in the screenshot. So it's kind of like you were creating the very thing that you're then arguing should result in the trial being moved.
You've mentioned the defense lawyers, and you named a couple, Daniel Patricelli and Mike Ramsey. I was wondering if you could maybe give a few words on the personalities of these lawyers, what their style was and how different it may have been, whether the styles of the lawyers helped or hurt. And I have to mention Mike Ramsey, who had a heart attack during the trial and then returned to the trial. Mike Ramsey is unfortunately deceased now, but it was on all counts really bigger than big.
It was bigger than big. And of course, Petricelli, you know, works for O'Melveny & Myers. It's a huge firm. He's now representing the rapper Travis Scott in the Astroworld case. You know, he was just a huge name in the defense bar. And in many ways, I thought the lawyers actually kind of represented the personalities of their clients a bit. You know, Petricelli is kind of flashy, flamboyant. You know, he represented Skilling. Ramsey, much more, you know, kind of old guard Houston, and really, you know, kind of, again, his personality seems similar to Ken Lay's in some ways, you know, a little more understated. But yeah, there was one moment where, you know, I was sitting in the overflow room, so I'm basically watching the trial on a big screen, and it's set up so that you see the witness stand. So we couldn't see a lot of what else was going on in the courtroom, and all of a sudden everything kind of stopped, and there's sort of murmuring and all this. And I found out later what happened was Petrocelli was addressing the jurors, and one of the jurors complained that his cologne was so overpowering that she couldn't breathe, and asked if he could basically go wash his face or something. I thought it was interesting because you don't often see that with lawyers in Houston, Texas. It's just not really something that comes up. But, you know, I think, the personalities of the lawyers really kind of represented the personalities of their clients in many ways.
Lord, could you conclude with a few words about the closing arguments? Did the government really focus on the technical aspects of it showing the accounting fraud? Did they talk to you or the jury, rather, about the bigger picture of hubris? And then really the closing arguments of the defense lawyers as well.
The closing arguments really did not focus a whole lot on the accounting stuff. It really focused much more on, again, this aspect that they knew what they were doing was wrong. They were trying to deceive people. It was a deliberate attempt to basically bamboozle their shareholders and their employees. And a lot of people were hurt by it. They really focused a lot on the impact of that. They had a lot of talk about, you know, because if you remember, Enron had a plan, as many companies did back then, that you could basically invest Enron stock in your 401k. So a great many employees had almost all of their retirement money tied up in Enron stock. And so when it collapsed, it not only put them out of a job, but it wiped out all their retirement savings. And so the prosecution focused a lot on that, a lot on the consequences and how this affected real people. Because it wasn't just a harmless lie. It wasn't just a CEO making hyperbolic statements about the success of the business. It really had real-world consequences. And, you know, the defense, you know, throughout the trial and then certainly in the closing arguments, engaged in what I termed in my columns the doofus defense, right? Which was, we didn't know any of this was going to happen. We didn't know this was wrong. There's an old thing in business law that, you know, stupidity is not criminal. And that was kind of the tactic they went, that it was just not something they could have anticipated. They didn't see it coming. So, you know, these things happen in business, except, of course, that they don't. So.
Well, Lauren, unfortunately, we are near the end of our time for this episode, but I hope our listeners will join us for part three, our next episode. We're going to take a little bit deeper dive into the testimony. Once again, I can't wait.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox. I hope you enjoyed episode two, The Trial of the Century. Even though the trial happened in 2006, it was automatically dubbed the Trial of the Centuries. And in many ways, it was the Trial of the Century. It was the first major accounting fraud case to go to trial of a multi-billion dollar company. Of course, we found out later that was all fraud. But before Enron death spiraled into bankruptcy, it was the seventh largest company in the United States. It turned out that was all fraudulent. But the trial really was everything you could ask for in terms of star power. There were, of course, Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling, the two Enron CEOs, current and former CEO on trial. And they had top-notch legal talent who in many ways mirrored their personalities. Mike Ramsey, really the dean of the Houston Criminal Defense Bar at that time, now deceased, represented Ken Lay in a very folksy, low-key manner. Jeff Skilling, much more outgoing, had Daniel Petrocelli, a well-known criminal defense lawyer who has represented many individuals, including the Donald Trump's business interests. So, very well-versed counsel. Ken Lay, it was interesting listening to Lauren Steffi because he thought there were two key turning points in the trial. The trial was, although based on accounting fraud, it was really to demonstrate how the leadership at Enron, as embodied in Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling, corrupted the entire organization. And they corrupted it by fraud, basically cheating. And the example with Jeff Skilling was that Enron beat every quarterly earnings call when Skilling was with the company by 1 cent. What he would do was, the night before the earnings call, he would simply go through the earnings statement and add a penny. And he knew what the investors, or rather the market, was looking for. So he just beat it by a penny. And he would re-engineer the financial statements to match what he had put in writing. And when that story came out from Enron's head of investor relations, it really showed how manipulative Jeff Skilling was. And he would do anything to beat the expectations of Wall Street. Ken Lay's Waterloo came when he was on the witness stand, and in his own direct examination, he questioned his lawyer and his lawyer's strategy. He simply asked, "Mr. Ramsey, I'm not quite sure where you're going with that." Well, when your own witness criticizes your direct examination, not your cross-examination, but your direct examination, that really signals that you're not a person to be trusted and that you're going to do whatever you want to do. And that's what happened with Ken Lay. It was basically over for Ken Lay at that point. A case was, as I said, accounting fraud, but the prosecution had to make it simple, and they had to give stories to show how Enron basically lied, cheated, and stole from their shareholders by giving them false information. The closing arguments came, and they were quite deliberate, and the prosecution focused on the damage that Ken Lay and Jeff Stilling had done, not simply in defrauding investors by stealing their money, but actually stealing the money of the Enron employees who had invested in their 401ks and other defined benefits plans that were available at that time. So the prosecution did a great job of breaking down a very complex case into very simple bites. The defense had a very difficult job and really lost it early on in the case, won around the earnings statements, rewrites by Jeff Stilling, and then Ken Lay demonstrating on the witness stand that the truth was whatever he said it was. I hope you enjoyed episode 2, and I hope you will join us tomorrow in episode 3, where we take a deeper dive into the testimony at the Enron trial.